Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And on today's New Statesman podcast, we're joined by the Labour MP and Committee on Standards Chair Chris Bryant to discuss the corruption scandal and how to clean up Parliament. As the Westminster corruption scandal continues to envelop more and more MPs, our guest today has been at the centre of attempts to clean up Parliament, often to the frustration of Number 10. Labour MP Chris Bryant chairs the Commons Standards Committee. It was his committee that last week's doomed attempt to protect Owen Paterson was seeking to undermine, but now ultimately may end up stronger. When he outlined the case against Paterson in the House, MPs listened in silence, many perhaps knowing the anger they were about to unleash.
As we say in the report, each of Mr. Paterson's several instances of paid advocacy would merit a suspension of several days. But the fact that he has repeatedly failed to perceive his conflict of interest and used his privileged position as a Member of Parliament to secure benefits for two companies for whom he was a paid consultant is even more concerning. He has brought the House into disrepute. A Conservative colleague, whom I respect a great deal, said to me on Monday that justice should always be tempered by mercy. I agree. But justice also demands no special favours. These are the precedents that we considered. Patrick Mercer was suspended for 6 months. Ian Paisley, sorry, I've forgotten his constituency, for 30 days. Jonathan Said, 14 days. George Galloway, 18 days. When Geoffrey Robinson failed to provide proper responses to the Commissioner and Committee, he was suspended for a month. These are the precedents. This case is just as serious because it involved at least 14 instances. It was a pattern of behaviour. And the member has said time and again over the last week that he would do the same again tomorrow. So if the House were to vote down or water down the sanction or carry the amendment, it would be endorsing his action. We would be dismantling the rule on paid advocacy. Which has been around in some shape or form since 1695. I'm afraid the public would think that we would be the Parliament that licensed cash for questions.
Chris Bryant, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Boris Johnson felt he had to declare on the world stage that the UK is not remotely a corrupt country. You've compared his intervention over the Owen Paterson case to something they do in Russia. Do you think the UK is a corrupt country?
I'm not sure the country is, but I think there's a danger, as Jonathan Evans, the head of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, said, of us lapsing into corruption. And I think some of the actions we've taken recently, or the government has taken recently, have been corrupting. And you see, I went to Mikhail Khodorkovsky's show trial in Russia. I've met with Alexander Navalny. I know quite a lot about Russia, and I've been warning about Russia for a long time. So I don't use that sort of comparison lightly. The truth is, it is fundamental to the rule of law that you do not change the rules suddenly at the last minute during a disciplinary process to benefit a named individual. That is the definition of the polar opposite of justice. So that's what I was referring to.
On the sort of polar opposite of justice, you voted mostly with Conservatives to prevent Rob Roberts, the MP for Dellin, facing a recall precisely because of this idea that, yeah, this quite fundamental.
It was going to be a retrospective motion. It would have applied. It didn't apply at the time that he went through his disciplinary process. The disciplinary process had all been gone through. For all I know, the independent expert panel Chester Stephen Irwin might have come to a different conclusion as to the sanction if the recall petition had been available to them. And so that's why I voted with the government against introducing retrospection on that. And I've maintained my position that I'm against retrospective legislation.
Yeah, I think lots of people were slightly surprised to see the Labour leadership calling for Rob Roberts to be kicked out, not because they agree with what he did, but for precisely that reason. What do you make of the fact that the Labour leadership has called for him to be kicked out?
Well, I understand why people want him to go. I mean, apart from anything else, the kind of humane part of me wants to say to Rob Roberts, if he was sitting here now, I'd say to him, Rob, you will, if you just hang around in Parliament like a bad smell until the next general election just to take the money, you know, that is what will define your life. If you were to leave now, I think you would stand a much better chance of reshaping, reforming your life. Otherwise, well, it's the same with Owen Paterson. You know, sometimes you just have to be straight with people. And says the biggest gay man in the room. Sometimes you just go straight with people. I'm not the biggest. Well, I am the only gay man in this room.
Our producer is making a face, actually, Chris.
He's not in this room.
You mentioned the Owen Paterson case. I was wondering, can I ask you a bit about the human side of that? Certainly has been talked about a little bit by Conservative MPs when that motion was being voted on. A lot of them were expressing their concerns privately about his personal circumstances with the suicide of his wife, Rose. And some people were concerned about the 30-day suspension and him having to face a recall petition and so on. And were wondering if maybe he should have been offered a shorter suspension in the light of his personal circumstances. I know that you touched on that briefly in the House of Commons, one of the debates, but I'm just wondering if you could explain the thinking behind sticking with the 30-day suspension.
So first of all, I'm not a big fan of the word suicide, actually, because it implies, you know, the term committing suicide implies the old understanding that it's a criminal offence and all of that. I have known people who've taken their own lives. And when I was a priest in the Church of England, I led the funerals for quite a lot of people, in particular young people who'd taken their own lives. So I know the mixed bag of emotions that are tied up in all of that. We did consider that in the committee. There was a view that we should have been going for a 3-month or a 6-month suspension, which would have been consonant with what had been given to other people in previous similar situations, like Patrick Mercer, who was given a 6-month suspension, or for that matter, Keith Vaz, different set of issues, but also 6 months. And it was partly because of all of those other considerations that we took it down to 30 days. But the biggest problem for us, I think, and emotionally still the biggest problem, is that Owen Paterson was adamant that he would do the same thing all over again. And of course, justice in a sense has to be blind as to the facts of a case. And the facts that we were talking about were obviously long before Rose Paterson took her own life. That's the kind of difficulty that I think any tribunal would face.
Mm. I sort of wanted to follow up on that. So obviously you've given two highly acclaimed speeches in the Commons about this. The first one
in 20 years. It's not a very good race. Yeah.
two kind of came speech in the last fortnight, the first on the first vote and the second afterwards. And one of the things I was very struck by in the second, you took a lot of interventions, including from Bill Cash, who'd been a big member of Owen Paterson's supporters club, as it were, in which you pointed out that actually, look, the thing about this case is the facts weren't disputed by anybody. It feels one of the issues we have, and one of the reasons why there's been these slightly alarming changes that have, you know, made Parliament seem and act in a more corrupt way, is this strangeness of kind of agreeing the facts but not sort of seeming to understand the need for sort of sanction. As someone who's, you know, chair of this committee that has been regularly criticised by other MPs precisely for that reason, how do you think that sort of kind of cognitive gap can be bridged?
I think Owen was in denial, probably still is in denial, and consequently he led all his friends rather up the garden path. And quite a few of them have said so to me since, you know, because he was adamant that they couldn't even table an amendment which cuts the suspension from 30 days to 9 days, because that would imply that he was guilty, and he refused to accept that he was guilty, and he said he would do it all over again. And, you know, when the vote happened, which he claimed that it all vindicated him and all that kind of stuff. I mean, all of that allied with an extraordinary campaign of vilification of the commissioner, which had all sorts of horrible tinges to it, like, you know, oh my God, she didn't go to Oxbridge. It was just all a great deal of snobbery and all sorts of vile things tied up in one. And it felt like a full-on barrage. There's one thing, incidentally, that this will seem a minor issue, but the reports from the Standards Committee, it actually says in the rules that they will normally be carried without any amendment or change and without a vote. And there was a vote in 1947, which ended up, the Labour Party was suspending Herbert Morrison moved that Gary Allagher be suspended from the House for 6 months. And then Winston Churchill tabled an amendment which doubled that, in fact, suspended him, expelled him from Parliament. So the only time that it's been changed is to make it a tougher, never going in the other direction. But the slight odd thing is that the committee proposes, but it has to wait for the government to table the motion, and then the government minister speaks to the debate. And Jacob Rees-Mogg took 45 minutes out of the 90 minutes allocated by the government to the debate, which meant that none of Owen Paterson's friends, other than Jacob, I guess, got to speak in the debate at all. And I thought that was a mistake. So and also the government left a week, which was filled. The vacuum was filled before we ended up with the debate. So I would much prefer a situation where motions from the Standards Committee automatically come to the House, decided by the Speaker, not by the government, and they're moved by the chair of the committee, not by anybody else.
You spoke about sort of Conservative MPs expressing their concerns to you. You gave a great quote in your I newspaper interview where you said it was the knob. Someone told you the knobs of the party told the oiks what to do, and the knobs don't have the best political antennae. I wondered if, without betraying confidences, you could tell us a bit about what you're hearing from your Conservative colleagues at the moment, now that so many other MPs are being sort of dragged into this story that's becoming wider.
Incidentally, the first write-up of that knobs versus oiks misunderstood the word knobs. an extraneous K appeared at the beginning of the words.
Oh dear.
I don't think that was the point that was being made. Lots of Tories are absolutely furious. I mean, I don't even have to breach confidence, because Philip Davis, I think, has published this. He said, you know, to the whips, don't ever tell me to vote for anything ever again, because it's not only that you persuaded me to vote for something which I was very uncomfortable about, but more importantly, then the next day you abandon that position. So everybody's left cast high, on a sandbank with no means of escape. And I think that that's a very strong feeling amongst a lot of Tory MPs, especially new intake, interestingly, many of whom I think previously thought that they owed their career to Boris Johnson. And now some of them think that they might owe their demise to Boris Johnson.
And I wonder how this moment feels to you, because you were elected in 2001, so you've had years of experience in the Commons.
1873 it was, 2001.
You've had years of experience in the Commons pre and post the expenses scandal. So do you feel that the current revelations feel similar to the precursor of the expenses scandal to you? Like, could this be one of those moments where lasting changes come in as well afterwards?
It actually feels more like the run-up to 1997. I wasn't in the House at the time, but I was around in politics. I was a local councillor in Hackney. And it feels like it for several reasons. One, because the word sleaze became, you know, very current. It's not a word I like, actually, because I don't think it's very nuanced. And, you know, in those days, being gay was sleazy. And I'm glad to say that's not quite how we view things today. So I think it's a little bit. But it is nonetheless like that, because every journalist I know is searching out sleaze stories. That's the currency for, and I think that will go on for months and months and months.
Chris, I'm just wondering, we're having now, off the back of this Owen Paterson thing, a much bigger conversation, as you say, about sleaze, about MPs' salaries, and about second jobs, which are, you know, to what extent certain ones are appropriate or not, and how far that should go. What's your view on that, given that you're looking into the MPs' code of conduct at the moment?
So the Standards Committee is looking at the Code of Conduct and what's in it, and what, I mean, all the content of it and its operation. We haven't really focused much on the issue of second jobs. So there is one recommendation that has come forward to us fairly, well, repeatedly since 2018 from the Committee on Standards in Public Life, which is you shouldn't be able to have a job where effectively, where you're a consultant and you're effectively a sort of paid advisor on how to get your way around politics. That just seems, that's a conflict of interest. That's the key issue for me. It's where there's a conflict of interest is the matter. And, you know, I mean, it's great having the letters MP after your name. Well, there's lots of places where it isn't, right? But I mean, when you write, I had a case in my constituency. Mr. Creamy Ice Cream is based in the Rhondda, and Mr. Creamy Ice Cream had been operating for years and years and years. Kerry Foods decided that they were going to start a Mr. Creamy Ice Cream, and Kerry Foods, being a massive operation, decided to sue Mr. Creamy because Mr. Creamy hadn't licensed the name. And I thought, well, and the company was frightened of closing, so I rang up the chairman of Kerry Foods in Ireland. It was a massive corporation. The chairman took my call straight out because I had the letters MP after my name. And I said, look, you probably don't even know that you're suing Kerry Foods. He said, no, you're suing Mr. Creamy. He said, no, I'm not. I said, listen, they're thinking of changing their name to Sub-Zero. If they just do that, why don't we get along like that? He said, brilliant idea. Everybody saved money. And it was only, he only took the call because I had those letters MP. So it's not using those letters MP inappropriately is the key issue. Now, being a GP, in some situations, being a lawyer, or for that matter, a dentist or a vet, or writing books or writing articles or doing a bit of broadcasting, all of that, it seems to me, there's no conflict of interest. You still want to know that somebody's got that work, but there's no conflict of interest. So there is an area where we could probably tighten up, which is that area where there's a conflict of interest.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to the New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So on the sort of issue of lawyers, you know this, having quite literally written the book on Parliament and its history. In times past, many, many lawyers did what Geoffrey Cox is now, you know, in the spotlight for doing, which is having a very extensive legal career. The fact that, you know, I mean, I personally wouldn't want my MP to be working quite that hard as a lawyer, but the fact then that has kind of declined is one of the reasons why the Conservatives in particular have struggled to recruit top quality people to be law officers, and why Lord Chancellor, Secretary of State for Justice, has become a bit of a problem position for them. There are obviously huge advantages to modernising the Commons in lots of ways, but do you think then something is lost in the quality and the variety of people in the House of Commons now that it has become a full-time job for most MPs?
Well, look, the truth is, I mean, I've in the last 2 years in particular, my casework has quadrupled. It's been much more intense than in all of my time as an MP. You know, that's put enormous pressures on MPs. You feel you have to answer emails, even if they come in at 11:30 on a Saturday night when you've only just finished watching the catch up of Strictly. So because I'm not watching the whole thing all the way through. There's far too much padding. And I'm not meaning in the costumes. I mean, padding in the show. I've got myself distracted by thinking about padding, which is a terrible mistake. I'm not thinking about Adam Peaty at all. But the point I'm making is about lawyers. So I think it is a full-time job now. It's really tough. It's 60 hours a week. Now, if you want to spend another 20 hours a week doing something else, I'm relaxed about that, as long as they're not a conflict of interest. And there are two other interesting traditions. In the past, if you asked another member of the House to represent you legally, it was the convention that they did so for free. So, I mean, that will be an interesting one to implement again today. And the other thing is, of course, we've had parliaments where you were not allowed to come if you were a lawyer. I think, I can't remember whether it's 1342 or 1432. I've got the date wrong, but it was known as the unlearned parliament because the king said no lawyers at all because they're just very irritating.
Yeah, again, talking of lawyers, I mean, you wrote in The Guardian that in the eyes of the public, this may have damaged the whole of Parliament, not just the Tories who voted for the nonsensical. So in your view, how should Labour be approaching this scandal and avoid being tarred with the same brush? Because obviously Keir Starmer has billed for hours as a barrister as well while being an MP.
Look, I mean, in my capacity as chair of the Committee on Standards, I care about the reputation of the whole House. As a Labour person, I care about the reputation of the House because it's the only way that you can achieve change. It's through, and I believe in democracy. As a social democrat, I want parliamentary democracy to work. So I hate the idea that there will be no checks and balances on government. I worry that over the last few years, lots of those have, you know, gone up in smoke, and I sometimes worry that the government is seeking to burn more of those. And I worry that, you know, constituents will just go, well, you're all as bad as each other, we might as well not bother voting. And then we've only had universal suffrage for 100 years, not even if you're including, you know, women at the same age as men. So I think this is a precious thing that we need to protect.
So how far do you think Labour should sort of dig in on making political hay out of the scandal then, to avoid what you've just sort of laid out as everyone sort of being seen as in it for themselves?
Well, in a way, that's not a question for me, because that's up to the Labour Party. I can be as partisan as I want as anybody else on other issues, but I'm not going to be on this, because I want anybody who ever appears before our committee to feel that they've had a fair hearing, which, incidentally, I'm absolutely convinced that Owen Paterson had. I think there are things that a Labour government or the Labour Party in the run-up to the next election must say. So I fully support the policy of saying that we wouldn't have people able to be employed as consultants, consultant lobbyists, as it were, as MPs. I'd like us to say that we will have far greater respect for parliamentary conventions, and some of those we might put into statute. I'd like to see the ministerial code put into statute. I'd like to see a future prime minister commit to that. And I'd like to see us believe in the checks and balances, which have all been dismantled. So I think there is a good programme for a potential Labour government to put in place.
So I have a very nerdy final question. You obviously did these two speeches.
It's not in your nature to ask nerdy questions.
Yeah, it will be a shock to our listeners, I'm sure. But you had two speeches, one in which you took a lot of interventions, which for listeners who aren't quite interested, is where people stand up, and one in which you didn't, both of which you had a lot of quite technical information that you needed to get across. In the second, of course, you had the exact wording of the motion you wanted to deliver. When you sit and write a speech and you know that you may be taking interventions, how is preparing for the two different from each other? And, you know, and what made you decide to do them in quite different ways? Yeah, that first one without any, and the second one with quite a few.
Well, as you may know, I don't normally write a speech. I normally prepare for a speech. You know, I've got the lines of what I want to say, the broad kind of area, and I've read into the subject, and I think I know what I'm talking about, and that's much more flexible. But I was aware, in relation to the Owen Paterson case, that I had to be very sort of straight and down the line and explain to people, some of whom might not have read the original report, and some of whom would simply not understand what was in the tabled amendment from Andrea Leadsom and the government. I just had to lay all of that out as clearly as I possibly could, and in as tight a linguistically as tightly as possible. And I was really pleased, obviously, that the House listened to me with quite a degree of attention, I think. And I know that some Conservatives changed their vote because of it. And my aim was to persuade people. sometimes you make a speech where you know you're not going to persuade anybody, but you're going to get it off your chest anyway. But sometimes you are only in there to persuade. And sometimes you plead. Sometimes you just try to marshal your argument as well as you can. You know, different tones of voice. I just thought that in this case, it was all. I felt like I was, I don't know, in front of a judge, and the House was the judge, and so I had to be as unflorid, as straight as possible, unflamboyant as possible. Which reminds me, incidentally, that when I was very first elected, the first BBC journalist to congratulate me said, "Aren't you a bit too flamboyant for the Rhondda?" And I said, "Do you mean gay? You mean gay, basically, don't you? You just mean gay."
What did you say?
I said, "Well, I'm only slightly gay. Well, actually, I'm completely gay, but I was breaking it to you." So.
Okay, well, Chris Bryant, thank you so much for your time in what's been an incredibly busy time for you and your committee. And we're looking forward to reading your report on potential changes to the standard system. That's coming out before Christmas, is that right?
It might even be an early Christmas. It might be out before Advent.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues, Stephen Bush and Alva Ray. We're produced by Adrian Bradley, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, and don't forget to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.